gun legislation, and the next step for DACA recipients. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Florida Senate gathered for a rare Saturday meeting to debate gun legislation.
A lot of our constituents back home wonder why we can't address guns.
It's not the weapon. It's the evil from within.
The bill does not go after assault rifles, but does allow teachers to arm themselves. The Florida House takes up gun legislation next, and we'll talk with Representative Keon McGee.
Hey, Gray House, what do you say? How many families you destroyed today?
Dozens of people marched this weekend in Fort Lauderdale to protest the failure of federal legislators to pass a permanent DACA plan. President Trump had called for DACA protections to end today. Only a court injunction is keeping them in place. We talk about DACA and what comes next for its recipients. That's Sundial Today. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Well, in the final weeks of the 2018 Florida legislative session, the debate over gun laws is taking center stage. After the Parkland shooting, students, parents, advocates of more restrictive gun laws have pressed lawmakers, forcing them to face this topic. Well, Saturday, the Senate held a special meeting over its bill, SB 7026. Earlier in the show, we heard Democratic State Senator Jose Javier Rodriguez and Republican Senator Kelly Stargell of Lakeland. At one point, senators voted for a freeze on the sale of assault rifles, apparently by accident.
The students and parents asked us to do one thing: make school shootings and assault weapons a thing of the past.
We continue to focus on the instrument that's used for violence when there's a vast array of instruments that you can use for violence, and people do.
That was Democratic Senator Linda Stewart, who represents Orlando, where 49 people were killed at the Pulse nightclub. We also heard from Republican Senator Dennis Baxley of Ocala. They quickly removed that portion of the bill. The House is expected to begin debate tomorrow. The legislative session is scheduled to end on Friday. We're joined now by Democratic Representative Keon McGee of Miami. Representative McGee, it's a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much.
Louis, thank you very much for having us. How are you?
I'm doing well. You guys are up there with less than a week left to end the session. And really, until the shooting, the issue of guns wasn't really even something to be discussed. Now it's center stage, again, because of the tragedy in Parkland. But again, let's look at what happened on Saturday. The Senate approves a two-year freeze on the sale of AR-15 rifles, assault rifles. Then they overturned that. It was by accident, I guess. Your response on Twitter was unbelievable, unacceptable, unbearable. So take us back to what you were seeing during that meeting.
Well, and thank you for having me. What we saw is that the NRA has more power than anyone can possibly imagine as it relates to our legislators here in Tallahassee. There were a meeting of the minds on the floor, and we saw this in the Senate, where members of both Republicans and Democrats came together to say that we need a moratorium on the sale of the assault rifles, which included the AR-15, while the commission studied gun balance within our community. And on a voice vote, you had both Republicans and Democrats agree. 20 minutes later, they then called a reconsideration motion, which allows for any member on the prevailing side to move for a motion to have a vote that will put every member yay or nay vote on the board of the Senate. And so within 20 minutes, there's a motion for consideration made, the motion carried, and you saw the vote turnout of how the members voted. And I believe it was really party line with the exception of two members from the Republican Party who switched over to vote with the Democrats who were not afraid of the NRA and their threats.
Now, you want your chamber, the House, to ban assault rifles. Why?
Well, that's what the Parkland students want. That's what 66, even two-thirds of America, of Floridians want. And that's what the single common denominator here as relates to the shootings, as it relates to these killers. You know, they use the AR-15 because the AR-15 lets off countless shots, over 10 at any given time. And if you add a bump fire stock to it, it shoots as if it's just an automatic weapon, which was already determined to be are illegal and under our federal law. Also, not only did the kids of Parkland ask us to deliver a ban on assault weapons, but they also are saying that they don't want to see their teachers armed in the classroom. And the current legislation would allow for teachers to sit in the classroom with firearms on their body. And I'm hearing also that there may be an amendment to that bill that would also now give non-instructional personnel the option and or the right to carry a firearm. And non-instructional personnel, for the record, is those who are like our lovely cafeteria personnel, like the servers, our custodian, our security guards who are in school who wear like the green shirts to identify themselves, and those who are non-instructional, those who are not teachers. So now, in addition to the teachers, they're talking about arming those individuals also.
All right, so you talk about the poll, the recent Quinnipiac poll, that a majority of Floridians are for tighter gun restrictions. But there was a poll, a CBS poll, that said a majority of Florida legislators want to leave gun laws left alone. What makes you think that anything's going to change this time?
Well, and this is where we have to change the mindset of this state. You know, legislators have to realize that we work for the people, and the people don't work for us. So if two-thirds of Floridians are telling us that they want a ban, who are we as legislators to substitute our knowledge for the very base that gave us the opportunity, the job, to work for them? And I think it's something that has been going on for the last two decades with those who are in power. Let's be honest here. You know, the Republican Party right now in the Florida House has 76 numbers, which means they have a majority. Under normal circumstances, what they would do is, and the Democrats have 41, they only need 59 votes to pass any piece of legislation or kill any piece of legislation. And what we've been seeing is, but for this gun debate, all of a sudden now it's a question of, you know, what is it that the legislators want? Well, the legislators are right now on the Republican side. They're in a bigot of a tug of war now, because it's not the Democrats who are in the minority who are stopping this thing from going up or down. It's the Republicans fighting back and forth with the NRA and trying to identify their identity. Because right now, you have to remember, for the past two decades, the Merriam Hammer and the NRA controlled every piece of gun legislation that had come out of this legislature. And this is where they're struggling. And they're trying to wrestle with their identity, but it's tough because Merriam Hammer and the NRA controls the leadership in the Florida House.
Again, I'm talking with Democratic Representative Keon McGee of Miami, and we're talking about, again, gun legislation. The Florida Senate had a special meeting Saturday and looking over Senate Bill 7026. It has a lot of different provisions, and as we heard, you know, part of it is at first they were talking about a freeze on the sale of assault rifles like the AR-15, but that didn't pass. Also discussing arming teachers, but also money for mental health counselors and making sure that schools have more resources when it comes to that issue as well. I want to get to some of those things. The Senate, by the way, right now is at lunch. They were talking about it this morning. They're expected to bring it back up within the hour when they get back. Representative McGee, taking a look real quickly at some of these other provisions in the bill, and I'm wondering what the House is going to be looking at, or what you believe the House is going to try to tackle here. As you said, part of it is arming teachers. Part of the bill in the Senate debate was about allowing, you know, for school districts to decide if they'd allow some of their teachers to arm themselves. Do you know of anybody, though, that who actually would want to go through with that? Because looking at polls, almost 40% of voters like the idea
of arming teachers.
Yeah,
but 60% are telling you no. And so, you know, this is the beauty of having a democracy. You know, the majority wins, and every idea is taken into account in crafting and directing bills and legislation. So the reality of it is if we have 60% saying otherwise, then unfortunately we have to look at it from that standpoint there. And let's also be honest here. There are some great provisions of this bill, like the mental health funding. That is brilliant. We, you know, this is where I agree and my members agree as I prepare to take the leadership as the incoming leader, this is where my members agree that, you know, we have to fund mental health adequately. We do. But we also agree that we should have a sworn police officer, you know, one per every 1,000 students. We call these resource officers in the schools. We agree with that, and we want them to be sworn. So, and we also agree that there should be a 3-day waiting period for purchases of the AR-15. Now, so we agree with that, but the poison pill in the bill that's giving many people, including Republicans, because remember, they only need 59 out of the 76 that they have, there's a struggle between that group to figure out how do they reconcile the 3-day waiting period and how do they reconcile going back to the constituents and saying that they had to be forced to listen to Marion Hammer and the NRA to deal with the issue of this bill. So it's a very tight spot they are in on the other side. We on this side in the minority, we know where we are, and where we are is saying, you know, we don't want you to arm teachers, and we don't want you to have a continuation instead of the AR-15.
All right. Some of that money that you talked about, they have part of it is $500,000 for mental health first aid training, $69 million for mental health assistance to school districts. How do you want to see that money allocated?
I would like to see the school district, the money allocated where the school districts per school district actually determine exactly how that money should be spent, because no one knows their community and their school better than the school boards and the superintendents. So I don't believe in this where the state government should dictate in every circumstance what local government should be doing. I think the local government, smaller government, are in a better position to know how this money is divvied up. So I support that. And I also support what the governor stated. Look, the governor has asked for more than $500,000 and more than $69 million for mental health assistance. He's asked for more than that, and we're saying the same thing. If we're going to really tackle mental health and we're really going to assist our local school boards in identifying those who may suffer from a diminished mental capacity, we at least have to put the money where our mouth is. So that's where also I know there's a difference between what the governor wants and what 76 Republicans in the House want, and that's again, there goes another rift between the Republican dominant House and the governor's mansion as to how much money needs to be funded. I agree with the governor. You cannot walk in and underfund this program. If you look at $500,000, Lewis, let's be honest. You know, you got 57 counties, $500,000, you break that up, and then you have to break that down per school. That is not, it is almost as if it's an insult. But hey, we got to start somewhere. But I'm with the governor on this one. We got to fully fund mental health assistance and mental health training.
Are you concerned, Representative McGee, that the funds needed for these various new school safety programs, whatever passes, is going to make it harder to pay for the other things the legislature wants to do?
Lewis, I have been in this process now going on 7 years. I'm going into my last term here. If the legislator wants to pay for something, the 76 members who are in the majority, they find a way to pay for it. They have been raiding the Sadowski funding trust, the Sadowski trust fund, for many years. They've raided pretty much every other trust fund that you can possibly imagine. So whenever there is something that they want to fund, they will find the money to do it. And this, you know, we cannot allow this dominant structure system here that they have an excuse to not adequately fund what the governor has asked for and what the families of Parkland have asked for and what we are asking for as an entire community based upon the poll. So whenever, you know, if they really want to fund this, Lewis, the resources are there. And by the way, we have not finished the budget. The budget is pretty, it's still wet. The ink is still wet. So we can go in and find the money that we need.
Again, I've been talking with Democratic Representative Keon McGee of Miami. As I mentioned, the Florida Senate was discussing their gun legislation. They went off to lunch. They should be back within this hour and expect to put a vote up today. And then, of course, the House will tackle it tomorrow. Again, as I mentioned, the session is supposed to end this Friday. Representative McGee, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for your time, sir.
Good. Thank you very much.
All right, still to come. Today was supposed to be the end of the DACA program. We're going to look at how that's impacting DACA recipients in South Florida. If you're dependent on DACA or someone you know and you want to share your stories or your concerns, we'd like to hear from you. The number is 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. More of that coming up here on Sundial on WLRN. Hello and welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, that's the sound of people marching in Fort Lauderdale this past weekend. They were marching for DACA recipients. That's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. That's an Obama-era program for hundreds of thousands of undocumented people who were brought into the country undocumented, like Diego Ramirez.
What I would like, I want to see is that our communities get more unified, more together, more every day, so we can fight not only for a clean Dream Act, but also to protect those that do not benefit from DACA or TPS because the fight is for I-11 million, and therefore we need to keep growing and growing. The Clean Dream Act is going to be a step, but we have to keep fighting more and more, and that's what I want to see. I want to see more of our community getting together to fight for I-11 million undocumented people in the states.
Well, today is the day President Trump had planned to end DACA, saying that he wants Congress to create a more permanent solution for those young people. But Congress has missed the president's deadline, and now the only thing standing between the young DACA recipients and deportation is a federal injunction that keeps much of the program in place until the courts decide. We're going to talk to an attorney who won that injunction later in the program. But first, I'm here with Jaciel Lopez, a DACA recipient who lives in Fort Lauderdale, and he came to us to the U.S. with his family when he was 7 years old. I also want to mention that we want to hear from you. If you have a story to share or if you have questions, we'd like to hear from you. And understandably, if you want, you can always just go under another name. But give us a call, 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. Mr. Lopez, where did you and your family come from before coming to the U.S.?
So I came from my family and I, we immigrated to the U.S. from Mexico in 2001.
How old were you at the time?
I was 7 years old.
Did you understand, by the way, everything that was happening, you know, when your family decided to come to the U.S.? Did you understand why and what they were doing?
Right. So, yes, I remember, you know, a little bit, you know, even though I was young at the age of seven, I do remember coming to the U.S. and I do remember the process of it, of what happened when we immigrated. And that's unlike some other DACA recipients who do come at an early age. You know, I was talking to another DACA recipient who came here at the age 6 months old. So like many of us come, you know, at such a young age that we hardly remember. I live very close to the border, so I do remember, you know, understanding that there was an other side. And we used to call it El Otro Lado, which is like the other side. So I always, I would know at the time that we were coming to the U.S. I just didn't know that I would have a different status. I didn't know that I was going to be undocumented. I didn't know that I was going to live differently than the rest of the United Americans.
When did you find out that you were undocumented, that you're living in the country and you are not a legal resident?
Right. So for many, this happened, you know, in high school, you know, when they're applying for colleges. I happen to know a little bit sooner than that. You know, maybe when I was like 10, 12, I started seeing my parents were telling me, you know, don't tell anyone you're undocumented. They could come and get you or they could deport you. When you speak to your friends in school, don't tell them that you don't have papers because that could lead to us being separated. So early on, you know, my family would be very cautious of how to proceed in the States because there's always a fear of deportation. I would see my mom every evening put on the evening news, put on Univision, waiting to hear something about, you know, immigration reform, waiting to see some way that we could fix our status. You know, unfortunately that has never come. But, you know, I was always, for the most of my life, I was aware of that, and it didn't become so. It became even more impactful when I graduated high school and I couldn't continue my studies into college.
Yeah, I know. That's when you really started to feel it.
Right, correct. Where not only that, you know, I couldn't drive because I couldn't obtain my driver's license. I couldn't, you know, apply for colleges. So I didn't really see an expansive future for me at that time.
Did you have conversations with your parents about why why did they try to make that journey? Why bring you here like that?
Yes, and you know, we talk about that, and I don't hold resentment. I know sometimes that can be the case, but I always knew that it was for a better opportunity, and they told me that, and I definitely understand that. My parents, you know, they sacrificed a lot of my parents. You know, they came to a country they did not know, without knowing the language, without knowing the system, so that I could have a better life. And I understand that now for sure, that that's why they did it. And I don't regret their decision at all.
What part of Mexico were they from again?
Baja California. It's in a city called Ensenada. It's just like an hour and a half away from San Diego in the States.
When did, or I should say, what has DACA done to change your life?
Right. So in 2012, when the program was first announced, you know, we gathered all the paperwork to file the application for DACA. And I was just graduating high school. It was actually, you know, it was, in June 2012, and I graduated in May. So it was soon after high school that, even though I had, you know, kind of given up on colleges, that's when DACA came about. So it gave me hope that I could continue my studies, and I did. So I was able to begin school at Broward College, and then eventually go to FIU, which I'm currently attending now, to pursue a degree in business. And you know, more than anything, it's changed my perspective and the idea that I could have a future here in the States, you know, now that I'm have work permit and legal status.
What were you thinking about when you heard President Trump say that, or not when he said, but when he had signed the executive order to end it?
Right. So following up to the September 5th announcement that DACA was being rescinded, you know, I kind of had that in my mind. You know, we sort of expected it. You know, it was being talked about, and there was rumbling. So there was already sort of expected that it would happen. You know, in my mind, I wasn't all that surprised. You know, I think after the election, a lot of people were saying, you know, no, you know, that's a ridiculous idea. He's not going to end DACA. Everyone is for it. You know, and a lot of things, you know, every time someone would say, you know, the Trump administration is not going to do something, they would surprise everyone and do it. And so when DACA was rescinded, you know, I wasn't all that surprised, because he had talked about so much about that. And it followed the narrative that he had talked about throughout the campaign and through the first year of through the first few months of his administration. So I wasn't all that surprised, but I definitely felt a renewed sense of fear, and for not only for myself, for my community, that we could be persecuted here in the States even after having DACA.
Do you still, as your parents told you, stay quiet, don't say anything? Do you still live that way? Do you still hide, basically?
Well, right. So I've realized that, you know, the gains that we've had as undocumented immigrants have come through speaking up and being open and talking to people and humanizing our experiences and our stories. So that is what has brought change, and the narrative has changed. You know, if you look at the polls, 86% of Americans support DACA recipients, and that has come through speaking up. So I no longer hide. I recognize that, you know, as humans, when we tell our stories, other people recognize that, and that is what has changed. That is what has changed the narrative, and that is what has moved the conversation from seeing immigrants as criminals, as bad, you know, citizens, to immigrants who contribute, immigrants who are part of our story, who are part of America. So I no longer hide. I speak up whenever it's possible. So that's why I'm here.
Again, I'm talking with Jaciel Lopez. He's a DACA recipient, lives in Fort Lauderdale. Just hearing some of his story, we're going to take a quick break. When we get back, we're going to talk to somebody we're going to talk with the advocacy group, the Florida Immigrant Coalition, to get another perspective on what's going on. Again, DACA was supposed to end today, but the courts are keeping it going. We're going to find out more about really what's the next step and what are the options for folks like Jaciel. And again, if you have a story to share, if you have a question about DACA, please, we'd like to hear from you. The number 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. More on this conversation to come here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Again, today was supposed to be the end of the DACA program. That's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. That was an Obama-era program. And President Trump had signed the executive order for it to end, but the courts have kept it going. And so we've heard just recently from a DACA recipient. He's going to be with us the rest of the program. But we want to hear from you, your thoughts, your questions. Maybe you are a DACA recipient. Maybe you took part in the march this past weekend in Fort Lauderdale. What are some of the questions and issues that you have on this program and what you want the president and what you want Congress to do? 800-743-9576. Now let me bring in Maria Rodriguez, the founder and executive director of the advocacy group, the Florida Immigrant Coalition. They want to keep DACA protections, of course. Maria, thank you so much for taking the time to be here with us today. About how many DACA recipients like Haciel live here in Florida, but then in the whole country?
There's about 24,000 here in Florida that are currently enrolled in the program, and there's close to 800,000 across the country.
You know the argument. Many people will say that the original problem was parents who broke the law by bringing these children into the U.S. illegally in the first place. Have you responded to that argument over the years?
I've seen the Dreamers over the last decade plus years and how they've, with so much courage, have spoken about being in golden cages and being Americans who have second class status because all they're missing is a 9-digit social security number. So it's really heartbreaking to see now, as this deadline looms, that our children are being exposed to becoming orphans and some of their parents widows of deportation machinery that's impacting not just immigrant families, but are impacting some core American values that we purport to uphold.
But what do you say to those people who have, and you've heard this, they've come to you and said, look, you're preserving DACA. Basically, you're just, you're allowing for, you're condoning an illegal act.
That's a minority of people at this point. As Haciel mentioned, a poll last week, a CNN poll, by a broad margin of 83% to 12% are in favor of protecting America's children as it relates to immigration enforcement. But what I would say to that minor segment that still does not recognize these folks as American, I would say that these are people who are part of the fabric of our community, of our economy. 95% of the recipients are working or in school and are integral to this economy. In fact, if we detain or deport them, it costs us from our tax dollars, but there's also an economic cost of their productivity.
President Trump has said that he supports the young people with DACA, but he wants Congress to pass legislation to normalize this situation. Where do things stand right now in Congress?
The DREAM Act has been a bipartisan, broadly supported bill since 2001. More than 16 years that bill has enjoyed. And today, Paul Ryan could put it up for a vote in the House and it could pass. It's not going to happen because there's not the political will. But that's what the American public wants, is to have these young people be given an opportunity.
Well, you just said that there's no political will. Do you have any hope that they're going to do anything?
Absolutely. We're going to continue pressuring. Right now, there's folks in D.C. that are mobilizing and protesting on this anniversary. We're not giving up educating, building alliances, connecting the dots between the struggle for access to college and the school-to-prison pipeline and criminalization, et cetera. We have until March 23rd. For the omnibus bill in Congress, and the DREAM Act could be attached to that bill, and there is an opportunity, but we need leadership, starting with the leadership of this state.
Now, of course, like any situation in Congress, there's always a give and take, and the bill that was in for DACA in Congress, I believe, right, was if they had also looked at, other changes to immigration laws, right?
So there had been three bipartisan negotiation processes where a group of bipartisan legislators have come to Trump with an agreement, and all three of them have been rejected by the administration. So there is will in Congress. Now, whether the administration wants to acknowledge that, specifically the DREAM Act, which enjoys so much support, there's no reason why it can't be put for a vote and be considered. Many other projects should be talked about, debated, and deliberated on, but it's unfair, unjust, and immoral to tie the fate of these kids with other many other issues.
How do you think you're going to respond if the eventual solution is that, you know, it doesn't include it includes some kind of penalty, but, you know, the recipients, you know, can't become citizens, or the parents can't become citizens, or they can't have residency? I mean, how do you think you would respond if that were the case?
I believe that above all, we want to protect people from detention and deportation, but we should be very vigilant not to undermine our own values. And to impact the DNA of immigration in this country is to impact the future of this country to the detriment of us all. So, you know, it can be very complex, but ultimately, immigrants and immigration are good for our nation. They're our competitive edge. It's part of our past, and it will be part of our future.
Again, I'm talking with Maria Rodriguez, founder and executive director of the advocacy group, the Florida Immigrant Coalition. And again, the number is 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. Your thoughts, maybe perhaps you know someone or you are living under DACA protections. What's going to happen if they go away? What's going to happen to your life? What are you going to do? Have you been thinking about that future? Let me turn back now over to, again, to DACA recipient Haciel Lopez. And Haciel, I'm curious, if it does go away, if Congress does nothing, or if the courts decide, you know, this program cannot continue, then what for
right.
you?
Right. So for me, you know, I'm finishing up my degree, my bachelor's degree at FIU. And, you know, my hope is that, you know, I can continue in this country, you know, as a resident and be able to pursue my career in marketing, be able to start a family and provide for a family here in the United States. You know, if DACA ends, you know, I lose that hope and I lose that future because I will not be able to pursue a career. I will not be able to, you know, provide for my family through a career that way. And for a lot of DACA recipients, that's already the case where they are losing their status, they're losing their work permits, and they're already being sent letters from their employers telling them that, you know, your work permit is about to expire, and if you don't give us a new one, we're going to have to fire you. So that's already a reality for a lot of folks. And for me, you know, it's that hope in that future that I will be missing out on.
Is there a reality in which you may have to leave, and where would you go? What would you do?
Honestly, I don't know. I don't, it's something that I don't, living here for 17 years, for the past 17 years and calling this my home, it's hard to think about anywhere else. It's hard to think about, you know, when I think about my future, I think about it here. I don't think about a future anywhere else. So it's a really hard thing to think about, really.
And your parents, what about them?
So my parents, thankfully, they were able to acquire residency status through my brother who sponsored them. So they will be okay, but there's no way other way for me to gain that residency like they have.
I want to turn over the phones real quickly here. Coming up, we're going to be hearing from an attorney who represented the University of California system in a federal lawsuit against the Department of Homeland Security. But again, I want to hear from you. The number is 800-743-9576. Let me start with Jerry in Miami. I believe it is Jerry. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Yeah, I'm a retired teacher, and I'm sure many of these students, young people, these DACA young people, were in my classes. Most of them, I would say, were excellent students, dedicated, looking to the future. We have expended, in my humble calculations, $8 billion to educate these young people. It's an investment in the future, investment in our country. And to dismiss them the way that this administration is doing, I think it's just appalling.
Jerry, if I may ask you, because as a teacher, did you ever know about students who were undocumented?
Didn't pay attention to it. They were just our students. We knew that there were students coming in we had temporary students who would come in for vacations in the wintertime from South America, and they were not citizens. They came to our school for a few months, learned to learn English, and were gone. And we absorbed them. And these young people have been here, they've lived here. They are like citizens except for a document.
Jerry, thank you so much for the call. Appreciate the comments. I want to go real quickly. I think I have one other call I can get to. No, I don't. We'll try to get to that call in just a moment. 800-743-9576. We're going to take a quick break here and come back. And again, we're going to hear from an attorney who was part of the federal lawsuit against the Department of Homeland Security. And we want to hear your stories or your questions about the issue of DACA. 800-743-9576. More coming up on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. So as we've said, the fate of DACA is now in the courts, and I'm going to bring someone else into the conversation to talk about that. Alexander Berengaut is an attorney representing the University of California system, again, in a federal lawsuit against the Department of Homeland Security. That suit is not yet resolved, but the judge has issued an injunction keeping DACA rights in place for young people who already have them. Mr. Berengaut, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Why is the University of California system, that's the state universities in California, suing the DHS?
Well, the University of California and its president, Janet Napolitano, obviously care deeply about this issue. There are thousands of DACA students who go to the University of California, and they're an integral part of the community. President Napolitano also has a personal interest in this issue because she was the Secretary of Homeland Security in 2012 when she first created the DACA program.
What is the argument that you made for the judge?
Well, the argument was under a law called the Administrative Procedures Act, which governs the way that agencies like DHS have to work. And our argument was that when an agency wants to take an action like the rescission of the DACA program, they need to provide a justification for what they're doing, and they need to take account of the interest that people have in the program and the ways in which they've relied on it. And we argued that DHS did not do that in this case.
And what's the injunction that you requested?
Well, what we asked the court to do was, while the case was going on, because of all the people who would be harmed during the case if the rescission was allowed to go forward, we asked the court to keep DACA in place until the case could be resolved. And on January 9th, the court entered what's called a preliminary injunction, which effectively does that. He, in most respects, kept DACA in place. There were a few areas where he tinkered with things around the edges. For example, he said that DHS does not need to accept applications from people who had never before received DACA. But for those who had DACA, the injunction allows them to continue to renew as if the program were still in force.
And that judge, federal judge William Alsup, didn't grant everything that you asked for. What did he leave out and why?
Well, so as I mentioned, he left out the ability for people who never received the program to apply for DACA status. Another aspect of the program that he didn't give us was one feature of the DACA program is something called advanced parole, which allows DACA recipients to travel outside the country and lawfully return. And people use that for all kinds of reasons, for professional opportunities, for student conferences, to attend to sick family members in other countries. And what Judge Alsup said was that he understood the concerns of people who thought this was important, but because it was a burden on the government to administer and less important than the ability of people to be protected from deportation and keeping their jobs, he said DHS was not required to restore this aspect of the program, the advanced parole feature, while the lawsuit was proceeding.
And he said the injunction applies nationally, basically into the courts, until the courts resolve the suit. The Trump administration asked the U.S. Supreme Court to rule immediately, skipping the appeals process. What did the Supreme Court do?
That's right. That's what the government asked. And last Monday, the Supreme Court denied that petition, so did not permit the government to skip the Court of Appeals and go straight to the Supreme Court. The court denied the petition and it said that it expected the lower courts to move expeditiously in deciding the case. So we are now back in the Court of Appeals.
Okay. And what's the next step? Has Judge Alsup ruled on the whole case yet, or?
No, well, so now we are, the Intermediate Court of Appeals, the Federal Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, is going to consider a range of issues that Judge Alsup ruled on. The injunction, he decided some issues relating to the government's attempt to have the case dismissed. And so the case before Judge Alsup is basically on hold while the Court of Appeals decides those issues.
How long is it likely for this case to work its way through the appeal system, presumably back to the Supreme Court?
Well, the Supreme Court, as you know, takes a break between June and October of every year. And one reason the government was pushing very hard to have the case skip the Court of Appeals and go straight to the Supreme Court was because they wanted the Supreme Court to hear this case, decide this case this term, which is to say before June of 2018. In denying their motion and giving the courts of appeals a chance to decide the issue, that will necessarily delay the time at which it could get back to the Supreme Court, probably at some point next term, which would begin in October 2018, assuming it gets there.
And there's another federal DACA suit. Tell us about what's happening there.
That's right. So there's another federal DACA suit that's going on in Brooklyn. In earlier, I guess in last month now, in mid-February, the court there also entered an injunction, which is identical to the injunction that Judge Alsup entered. So they cover the same people. They have the same exceptions. They're 100% the same. That injunction is also now being appealed by the government in that Court of Appeals, the Court of Appeals that oversees New York and several other states on the East Coast. So now those two DACA injunctions will be heard effectively simultaneously by the two courts of appeals.
And what if that judge decides differently from Judge Alsup? I mean, what happened to the injunction?
Well, so that judge did grant the injunction, the trial judge. So now, if the two courts of appeals have the case, they could either affirm their lower courts, uphold the injunction, or they could split, and one or the other, or both, I guess, could reverse. The Supreme Court, when they decide whether or not to take cases, one thing they look at is whether the lower courts have divided and taken different approaches to an issue. So the way the lower courts address the issue will probably affect the likelihood of Supreme Court review. But as a technical matter, so long as one injunction is in place, DHS has to continue processing renewal applications on behalf of DACA recipients.
Again, I've been talking with Alexander Berengaudi, an attorney representing the University of California system in a federal lawsuit against the Department of Homeland Security. That suit not yet resolved. But the judge, again, has issued an injunction keeping DACA rights in place for young people who already have them. Alexander, I want you to stay with me for just a moment here. I want to jump back over to the phones real quickly and get a couple of folks in here. I've got Michael in Miami. Michael, thank you so much for being patient. Welcome to the program.
Well, good afternoon. Thanks for hearing.
Go ahead, Michael.
Well, hi. I was just calling. First of all, I'd like to say that I'm an American-born citizen, and I am very sympathetic to the plight of the undocumented children that have been brought to the country of no fault of their own. But I think, you know, in terms of a human response, not a political one, I'd like to hear a little bit from some of the folks that are on DACA or supporting the program about, you know, what they can do beyond just participating in the economy and getting an education and having a driver's license. What they feel they can contribute or give back in terms of gratitude for the privilege of being here. And I think that would go a long way to furthering the conversation with folks who may be on the fence about folks with that status. I can tell you myself personally, I'm very happy that those folks have the opportunity. But I think we should also address some of the costs to the country. In terms of resources being expended and things like that. I would just be interested to hear someone tell me a little bit about that, please.
Okay. Well, Michael, let me turn that over then to our guest here who, again, Haciel, who is a DACA recipient. Michael, thank you so much for the call. Let me go ahead and put that to him. Haciel, you've heard this before. What Michael is saying, beyond just a couple of things, I mean, what do you bring to, you know, to being here living in the United States? As you hear, there are people on the fence about this issue. What would you say to convince them otherwise?
Right. Well, that's a common, you know, question or common thing that people will say. You know, I'd say that DACA recipients, you know, are exemplary citizens. You know, I am part of a community. I don't just work and go to school. You know, that's something that a lot of DACA recipients are, you know, when you look at them, you know, they're going to school, they're getting their degrees. And but we are also part of the community. You know, I serve in my church. I do as much community work as I can. And that could be said of a lot of other DACA recipients who I know who are also very, very close to their community and are part of it and are part of the fabric of this nation, like Maria was saying earlier. But it is an issue of humanity. And, you know, oftentimes it doesn't matter how much we talk about our stories, how much we talk about how exemplary we are. There will still be people who say that we don't deserve or that we shouldn't be here because of our status.
All right, well, let's find out. I want to go over to Reza. I hope I'm saying that correct, from Miami. Reza, welcome to the program. Yes. Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I'm an immigrant to the United States also. I've been here for more than 20 years, and I went through all the hoops and forms necessary to get my residency legally. And I just don't understand the logic of how people can think that if you come here illegally, that you have rights to be here. And nobody is addressing that issue. They're sort of forgotten that these people came illegally, and now they're entitled to rights. I don't understand why.
All right, Reza, thank you so much for the call. Reza brings up a good point. She went through a process. We hear this argument. Maria Rodriguez, let me bring this to you. She says, look, I went through a process. They didn't. That's not fair.
They would love to go through a process and fill out a form and stand in line. But it's consensus knows that the immigration system is broken. And as Bishop Wensky says, this is not about bad people breaking good laws. This is about bad laws that are separating families. I think it's important to also note that we have to be very aware in terms of gratitude or privilege. We're talking about people who are contributing to this country. And I don't see the same concern about gratitude and privilege to the farm workers that are in this state, to the people who uphold the tourism in this state, who are working sun up to sun down, who are not only giving so much and receiving so little, but are also having to fear detention, deportation, la migra, sometimes the police. It's very unfair because we benefit from people's work and their labor, and we shouldn't have to justify people's humanity and recognition of their full civic selves.
All right, Alexander Berengott, real quickly in the short time that I have, what about Congress? If you know, they haven't had much success in resolving this issue, but what if they do pass a bill? In whatever that may be, how would that affect the lawsuits?
Well, if Congress passed a bill that protected DACA recipients or improved on the protections that they received under the program by giving them a path to citizenship, then I think that would really moot the lawsuit. I mean, we wouldn't really need to protect against the rescission of the program unlawfully if the Congress created a new and better program to replace it.
All right, I've been talking with Alexander Berengott. He's an attorney representing the University of California system, again, in a federal lawsuit against the Department of Homeland Security. That judge issued an injunction keeping DACA rights in place. It was supposed to end today, but because of that injunction, it is still in place. And people impacted by that include one of my guests, Hacia Lopez, who is a DACA recipient who's lived here now for more than a decade, way over a decade, living here in South Florida. And he's waiting to see what happens next. I also have been talking with Maria Rodriguez, founder and executive director of the advocacy group for the Florida Immigrant Coalition, again, fighting for DACA protections. And look, we want to hear again from your thoughts, and I want to hear up and down the spectrum, because we did hear folks who are on the fence. We heard from one caller who is against all of this, who doesn't believe any of these folks deserve to have that opportunity. We'd like to hear your thoughts. You can find us on Twitter at WLRN Sundial, on Facebook. Again, just look up WLRN Sundial. That's the end of the program. Thank you so much for listening. Remember, find us on iTunes, WLRN Sundial. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful day. We'll talk tomorrow.